Cool.
Okay.
So then we can catch this afterwards. All right.
All right. My name is Dennis Herr. I'm here to present testing with Python and Docker. What I hope to show you today, are you guys all using Docker today? Where are you at? What's your background? So you are using Docker,
yeah,
using it in production?
Using Docker in the discovery environment to run our software, but also, yeah, for continuous deployment of our software.
Okay, good. So what I hope to talk about is how you can have your Python image support development, unit testing in production environment, one image. How you can use tools like Docker Compose to do your system testing. So you bring up everything like databases, microservices on your local machine, and fire those all up and have a whole system running on your local machine. And then finally, talk about continuous integration testing, where if you check something in, it would use tools like Docker Compose to run those tests for you. The stuff I base this off of was a book called Using Docker. It came out in December 2015, and it's a really great book, but it was outdated by the time it hit because this environment is changing so fast. So what I did is I took the examples. The reason I like this one is it is a holistic enterprise model, how you would develop. And even though it's outdated, the basic concepts in that book are still good. And so I updated the chapter 8 to be more in tune with what we do today in today's world. If you don't know what Docker containers are, they spin up real fast, or simpler, faster, more robust way of developing and distributing software. Basically, you build an immutable image and you deliver that to your different environments. And so it makes it more reliable and when you push stuff out.
Should I ask you a question?
Sure, go ahead.
Is an image different than a container?
A container is an image. So when I say image, container, you can just think of it the same thing. That's a good question.
Usually explain it as the image is, a container is a running image.
Running, yeah, that's a good way to say it.
Okay.
How is it different from like a virtual machine is, you know, virtual machine, you have your hypervisor like VirtualBox, and then you got to spin up the whole OS, and then you can run your apps on there. So that's pretty slow. You know, you're talking minutes there. Where on the Docker engine, you basically, it's carving out a little sandbox to run your libraries, and you can spin up in milliseconds. So it's a lot faster to bring up than bringing up the entire operating system and repeating it. Is there any questions on that? One of the things that is nice about Docker is I think it gets rid of the need for configuration management tools like Ansible, Chef, Puppet, SaltStack. What those tools do in traditional sense is they provision one or more services on a virtual machine. And usually they point it to an environment, and that their task is to get it up to date to where you want it for that particular environment. The problem with that is, you know, it's a lot of overhead, and it's hard for development to be involved in that, I guess, because it's kind of outside of their scope. Usually a SRE team takes care of it, or a DevOps team. But also you have problems like drift. Like, you know, you might be able to go to all the environments perfect, but when you go to production, the boxes is a little bit different for some odd reason. So even though it's supposed to be the same, and, you know, your production goes down because, you know, Chef can't sync up right. So that's another risk. I've seen that a couple times myself, where everything works perfect until you get to production and it craps out, and then you got some downtime. With Docker, you have a Docker file. That is basically your configuration management that tells you, you know, how to build a machine and the things that you need with it. And it's an immutable image. Once you burn that image goes to your different environments. So you're not, you don't have to deal with drift. What else can I say about the Docker environment? Another thing, I guess, is like virtual machines usually have one or more services. With Docker, you only have one service per container. And so it's isolated to that. That makes it easier too, that, you know, sometimes when you have multiple services run on the same box, maybe update a library, go to a newer version of Python, that would cause bugs with the other service. So this keeps it isolated. You can just focus on what you're working on for your features, and not worry about the collisions with anything else on that box. So that's a nice feature of that. I got a little thing that says tip. What we do in our productions, we use EC2, we use a compd to basically rewrite the environment variables for that target environment on the image itself. So we use like play framework a lot, and it has like a config file, and this will go ahead and grab the secrets, decrypt them, and then overwrite that config file on startup on that, and it's called a sidecar pattern. I'm not going to go into that today, but that's something to look into.
Good questions? Where did the sidecar pattern come from? I know you don't want to go into it, but is that something that's used in traditional infrastructures as well, or is it something that's...
Well, Docker, it seems like it's a Docker thing. There's like several different patterns. Sidecar is one where, bolted on the side, like a motorcycle with a sidecar, and does certain tasks. And
okay.
In this case, we have a generic compd pattern that we give to development teams. And if they follow that pattern, here's the config files I want to change. Here's where I grab the environment information. And so what we have in-house is we use KMS for encryption. We use DynamoDB to store the value. So anything that's secret is encrypted, and anything that's not is plain. And then we pull that down, put it in there. And of course, we have a change config on DynamoDB so we can know if something's changed. Like somebody misconfigged, I can go back, go what happened, see who changed it. And that's more on the SRE team side, not the development side.
I guess we'll get into more into that about how you can test these things, package them, and ship them without having to bake in secrets and things like that.
Yeah. Basically, standard practice is environment variables that you pass in when you fire it up at runtime. Problem with that is you might have some secrets that might be vulnerable. I mean, if they just get a hold of the environment, they can see all your secrets.
Yeah.
So that's not, some people just lock down files for a user. And a config file, and then that stuff starts up and reads that. Docker is great, but I just wanted to touch on serverless model. You probably heard of that, like AWS Lambda. I think Google Compute has something. I think everybody has something now. Where with Docker, you have to host it. And so even if you're not using it for any services, you have all this infrastructure sitting there that you're paying for. What's nice about Lambda is you have like a piece of code that runs in Python. You can put it out there, and if nobody ever calls it, you don't pay for anything, and you don't have to worry about all the infrastructure around that. And if it gets called, you pay for that. And if it gets slammed like a million hits in a second, AWS Lambda is responsible for scaling that up to handle that load for you. You don't have to write any of that stuff. That's all pushed off to Lambda, which makes it nice. The caveat of that is there's some limitations, like you can't have any transactions that go over 5 minutes before Lambda will chop you off. There's also memory constraints, only certain versions of Python that are supported. So, but still nice, a lot of people use it. I see more and more microservices being pushed to serverless. And they do have open source stuff to run serverless on your local machine. And Amazon has something called SAM to spin up your little serverless environment locally as well. The Docker registry, so when you burn an image, you usually publish it to a public or private registry. So one you might know of is hub.docker.com or store.docker.com. Amazon has their own, what's it called? ECS store or something, I don't remember what it's called. Oh, we use something called Quay. And the reason we use that is it's private, and it also does a scanning of security vulnerabilities for us and gives us a report saying, here's the vulnerabilities. And if there's a fix for it, it'll even tell you how to do an update to this library to get rid of that vulnerability and stuff like that. So those are some nice features with that registry. So we can just go take a look at Docker store here. If you're looking for something out there, use like Python image, you just go type this in. Here's all the stuff that's related to Python. So here's the official image here. I can go ahead and click on it. I can see all the different versions that are available. There's 3.7, 3.6, 3.5, 4, 2.7. So if you want to pull down a specific version, you can, when you pull it, I'll show you how to do that a little bit. You can specify a specific version, or you can always go with the latest by not specifying a version. But it's usually best to lock down your stuff so you don't, next time you build an image, doesn't fail on you because they introduced something that, or maybe took away a method that you're dependent on in an older version, and now you have a bug. So if you want to pull that down to your local machine, you have to have Docker installed, and you just do a Docker pull Python. It'll pull down an image if it doesn't already exist, or if it's updated. These images are like slices of, how to describe that? Help me out here. How would you describe, you know, the little run, little slices of Docker?
Layers?
Yeah, layers, I guess. So if it already has that layer and the newer version didn't touch that layer, it doesn't take the time to pull it down. It already has it. So you're not pulling the entire image down every time. You're pulling pieces of it. And
so when you're talking about a layer, is that like at the beginning of the Docker file, or is this from whatever pool?
Yeah, that would be
your biggest. Yeah, thing. Every run is a layer.
Okay.
Every little piece in there is a layer. And so if you change anything at that point, so if you had like 10 runs in there and you change the run on 8, everything else will be considered cached. But anything after that, it can't guarantee. It'll generate the same image. It'll rebuild all those images after that, or all those layers after that to make sure it got everything.
Yes, we have a lot of similar images. You want to keep all the common stuff at the top of each Docker file, and then all share those same layers and get your stuff at the end of the Docker file.
And that's how the registry, I think, works too. Otherwise, you know, if you had like a 10 gig image and you're burning 20 a day, you can imagine how many terabytes. Well, if it's the only change in one thing, you know, it's only keeping track of the changes and not reburning the area. It's not keeping all that stuff together. What else? Back to. So if you want to pull something down, you can just do a Docker pull Python. I don't know how to. You know how to make this terminal bigger on PyCharm?
Yeah.
I tried to do it through. I got this part bigger.
Yeah.
And I'm here. This is so tiny. I don't know if you guys can see it.
It's not too bad because people are streaming it from.
Yeah, maybe I can scale with it.
Yeah, it's the console somewhere, color scheme console font. There we go. And we can override it.
I think 16, that should be big enough.
That's a different one. Terminal, we've got Python. Sorry, console font. No, this is something else.
I think you have to close it and bring it up there.
Sure. Oh, you mean the terminal you have restarted?
Yeah, let's see if I got it. Yeah. Console.
That's okay. Can you guys see it okay?
Yeah, in chat, there's, I guess, those are more.
Okay. Yeah, you may just have to like do that, but.
Okay. So I have a little cheat sheet here. Yeah, pull my commands out of. So what this did is look to see if it had the image and check the checksum on it and found out I already have it. I got the latest, so it's just going to leave it alone. If I delete that. So if you want to see what the Docker images that you have, you can just say Docker images and grep for Python. Oops, got to type in grep. I can see that I have 3 Python images here. I got the latest. Which 3.7, you got the Alpine version of the latest, and then 3.6. I guess you should talk about Alpine. Alpine is a very slim version of the OS. It's like 5 meg out of the box with this Alpine. As you can see here, it's 79 meg. with the Python image loaded on top of it. So, you know, 73 or so megabytes is the Python package, but the Alpine itself, the operating system, is only 5 meg. So it makes things a lot smaller. And if you look at the next line, it's saying 923 meg. That's just a base image of, I don't know, it's using Debian or something like that. So you're talking at least more than 10 times smaller when you use Alpine than what the like a traditional Ubuntu or Debian uses. And why that matters is when you're bringing stuff, a lot of stuff up with containers and memory, you know, I could bring up a dozen of the Alpine versions of Python and not even come to the same size as one running in one Debian running a container. So a lot of people focus on, they might build with traditional one because they need like libraries and stuff to compile. But once they have the compile thing, some people push to Alpine, or some people just stay on Alpine if they don't have any restrictions on libraries and stuff. Some people have complained about it. Alpine, I have never run problems, but I do know that some people do have issues with it, but I don't know what they are, and I haven't run into it myself. But I think it's pretty nice. I haven't run any problems with Python, and would recommend always trying to use your production image as an Alpine image. Is there any questions on that? So these are all other different commands, Docker pull, Python Alpine. That's how I got these other ones down. I can go ahead and grab the 6 Alpine. So you can see it go pull down the layers. So already had pieces that already existed, probably the base Alpine image, and then pulled down the changes there and completed. So these are the layers that we were talking about earlier. Is there any questions about that? Okay, move on to the next slide here. And so now that you have that Python image, if you want to run it, this is how you bring up a Python shell. And there's a Python shell. So let's go ahead and exit out of here. And if you want to bring up the bash command to take a look at that image internally, you just pass this in. Instead of a...
So that changes the default entry point or something?
Yeah, it changes the entry point instead of being the Python shell. It'll kick it over to bash shell. And now you can enter inside that shell, and like you see I'm in as root, and I can look around and see all the stuff that's on the image. It's great for troubleshooting or, you know, seeing if you have a package installed. All right. So we covered the Python shell, bash shell. The Docker file, again, the Docker file to me is, when you hear like Chef or Puppet or Ansible, to me the Docker file removes a need for that. Let's take a look at a Docker file. So this from is what the base image is. In this case, it's a Python 3.6 image that I'm pulling down and using as my base, and then I'm gonna run commands to manipulate that to do what I want it to do. So in this case, we're adding a group and user called UWSGI.
UWSGI,
is that how you say it? What does that stand for? I know
it's micro whiskey. So it's a whiskey stands for Web Server Gateway Interface. It's a API standard for how web applications interact with Python, between Python and web server like Nginx.
And that's more scalable in production version, right?
Yeah. So okay. It's that's just UWSGI is an implementation of the WSGI interface.
Okay.
But yeah, you could, like Django has a it's the way you can have Django use UWSGI to talk to Nginx and stuff. Yeah.
So in this demo, we have Flask with the UWSGI on top of that for production mode only. and bringing in a request library in Redis through pip. So we create a user and then use pip to pull in the libraries that we need for Python. This work directory here is saying, you know, when you start up, jump to this directory called slash app, so it's off the root. And then that copy app to app is basically saying copy this app directory, all the contents under that, to the app directory. And so all the work directory will then contain the identidoc Python and the test Python. And then this next one here is a startup script for the image. So I'm copying the command shell over to the root of the image. Let's expose here. So you have the container will keep everything isolated unless you tell it to expose. So these are two ports that need to be visible for production mode. And so this exposes the 9090-9091 to the outside world. Didn't have that, you wouldn't be able to see anything. So that's what that's doing. And then that user on line 13, what's doing is toggling over to the that user that we created above. Because as a standard practice, you never want to run as root in your Docker container.
Even in the Docker container, even though it's isolated.
Yeah, that's best practice for security reasons. You know, you're running as root, you can get access to everything, or this adds another layer.
Maybe you access everything in the container, but not
the. Right. I think there's probably some reasons.
That there's some esoteric stuff, ways to hack through if you're on root, and this gets rid of that.
And actually, that's one of the reasons I think why Singularity is popular in HPC, because you can't actually be a root. They block that road for specific reasons. But yeah, it's sort of above my pay grade.
Yeah, I'm not a OS guy, but
we still on.
Yeah, so best practice is always to create a user and switch into that. And then so that line 15, the command shell, that's what it's going to start up as. So let's just go ahead and take a quick look at that. So I said in the beginning, one of the things we're going to demo is how we can toggle environments. So if I'm running in dev mode, I'm just running the executing the Python, identidoc Python. Which will bring up Flask, and you know, if you make changes, it'll go ahead and self-compile. This unit here will run the test Python to run the unit tests by passing that environment variable. If I don't pass in any variable, then what it does is assume production mode, and this is where it toggles to use the, what do you say, WYSIWYG?
Whiskey.
That fires up, and so you're on different ports. So the thing is, this is running on port 5000 by default. When you turn this on, it's switching over to 9000. So it gets a little bit tricky. So when I talk about the next line here, the health check, what this is doing, this is a nice feature. This is one of the best features that they added to Docker in the last year and a half. And what this does is if it's failing, your Docker container will not, you know, you'll kick it out. So
is this a way to put any check in there? Can you put any kind of check in there just to check, like maybe if your application expects certain files to be in certain places that they...
Yeah, usually you write like a healthy Z. There's a, if you look for healthy Z Hightower, he's a guy at Google. He basically kind of created this pattern where traditionally you would have monitoring outside and people writing scripts and hitting it and testing it out. And that doesn't make sense because you're the developer knows what's important. So why don't you write a health page for health checks? And you know, if you need a database, that's important. If the database is not there, you can't do anything, then you know, fail the health check. And if you have like 50 services that are critical, fail. But if you have services that are, you know, okay, they could be down because they're not critical, don't, you know. So you leave it up to the developers who know their customers and their requirements best to write the healthy Z page. In this case, I don't have a healthy Z monitoring. What I'm doing is just hitting to see if this page returns a 200 using the curl command. So if the fail flag here says anything but 200 is a failure. So if this fails, because I could be not, if I'm not in production mode, I'm not going to have port 9090 visible. So that would fail and go, it'll check to see the dev mode. You know, maybe we're in dev mode on port 5000 and check that. If that fails, then it'll exit one and you'll see the health as bad. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So you probably would write a health page that would do all this magic and more behind the scenes, and it would spit out, well, like, this service I need is not visible. So it makes it really nice. So again, infrastructure as code, easily use tools like Terraform, AWS CloudFormation, but Docker comes with Docker Compose, which you can use on your local machine to do that infrastructure as code. And take a peek at that. So here I got two Docker Compose, one for my continuous integration server and one that I use on my development machine. So if I, what this is doing is saying, what's my environment look like? What machines do I need in order to run? And so my AdanaDoc, this build says, you know, build this if the image is not there. So it'll go ahead and build the Docker file. And what it's doing here is I want to be in dev mode here. So I expect the port 5000 to be there, and I'll just expose it to the local host on my host machine as 5000. So you can make this anything. If you like port 8080 better, you know, you can say 8080, so 5000 will be visible to your local host on 8080.
So if you already have something running on 5000 locally, yeah, you can expose it as something different. You don't have to use the same port.
Right, exactly. And then the volumes here, I'm mapping the volume. So I can make changes and would automatically pick up while I'm developing. And in this links here, these are service links to these other two images, VM Monster, which generates an image I'll show in a little bit. So this is a microservice that starts up based on an image and then Redis. One of the things I could say about the health checkers, like, so these will all start basically at the same time, but you can say, you can also add something else that says depends on. So if I need DN Monster takes 5 minutes to start up, I could say, you know, AdanaDoc depends on DN Monster, so we'll wait before it fires up the other one. But as it is, the default timeouts on the health checker that we have in AdanaDoc are long enough that when these are starting up and it's failing, it'll wait, and then it should be up in that time and show us healthy. Is there any questions about this Docker Compose?
You obviously wouldn't use the app volume binding in productions. That's just for your development environment.
Right.
So what does it look like? So in the production version of this, it would just have not that. Okay.
So we'll cover continuous integration. So I have a different Docker Compose version, and notice my ports are missing. I could have a multi-branch builds going on a machine. If they all opened up port 5000, they collide and fail. And nobody's going to look at it anyway because it's on a continuous integration server. So I leave the ports off. And so those things are isolated to Docker Compose running them. It won't be exposed to that box, which is nice. And then I'm saying run in production mode. And that's it. Does that answer your question?
Yep. Thank you.
Okay. And you could have many. I did work with one team. We had to have like two different Docker Compose for continuous integration. One did this one where it did a system test, and it was using MySQL. And for some reason, MySQL on Amazon isn't the same MySQL. But you know, they have RDS. It's not exactly the same. So what their problem was is they would test it and be fine. They could test it in a few seconds because they'd spin up, you know, the Docker container for MySQL, populate it, and okay, it's good, ship it, and it fail when it goes to production. So what we did is we had another Docker Compose that actually used Terraform to spin up the RDS instance with certain credentials that allowed that user, it was a service user, to only could start up machine with this name on the RDS, and that would take about 10 minutes for RDS to come up and then run all the scripts and then tear it all down. And so that was nice for them. So, I mean, that's more your deep, you were talking about, you know, continuous, what did you call it?
Analysis.
Analysis, you know, it's not exactly the same, but this one is doing more deeper inspection as it you're doing some tests. So that's kind of cool. I didn't think I could do all that, but with Jenkins it was easy. All right, before we get too far off track.
Yeah, we are scheduled to finish at 1, so.
Oh, so I better get looking here.
Sorry.
So the AdenaDoc app, what it does is generates a unique image based on your username. And so these are examples of the images that could be put out there. And so this is out on GitHub under my user AdenaDoc. That's what we're looking at when I show this. And so the AdenaDoc program, it builds upon a official Python image. It uses volumes for dynamic code changes. It maintains those three different environments that I talked about, production, test, and development. And we use code Compose, Docker Compose, to automate the development workflow. I guess I got ahead of myself there. Already covered all this stuff. So, you know, what's nice about this is if you're building something, let's say I have my laptop crashed, I can't recover it, I bought a new laptop. If I have Git and Docker installed on the machine, I can download that whole development environment and have the thing up in a matter of seconds. That to me is the most powerful benefit of using Docker for development. Does that make sense to what I'm trying to say there? I come from the Ruby world, and I remember it would take 2 weeks for a person to get their machine set up, and you'd still have issues.
Look at David nodding.
So if this is a Ruby example, that 2 weeks is gone. It's now a few minutes. You know, you just check out the Git, all your infrastructure, you know, all that stuff, all that, configuration is done. And brings it up, and it's just amazing. It blows people's mind that, oh, you know, I lost my machine, died. Well, it's no big deal anymore because you just pull it out of Git and you're off running again. So that makes it really nice. So it's kind of like virtual environment, but I think a little more on steroids. You wouldn't use, I guess you could, but I don't see a need that you use virtual environment Python with when you're doing Docker development. Does that make sense? Okay. Unit tests. So let's go ahead and fire this thing up. Is there any questions so far?
I have questions, but I don't want to slow things down, so
we can save those to the end.
Yeah.
I don't think we'll slow it down while I'm looking for stuff to do here. Let's see. So I already got it cloned down. So this is the cloning. I can see the image if I pull it down. So I'll just go ahead and grab it to make sure I have the image local. No, I do. Docker command.
Oh, you're in Docker.
Oh, that's right. Thank you. Yes. Get rid of that paste. You can see I have two images there. Not sure why. Oh, one's probably because I fired up on Docker. And the other one's Docker Compose. But so I'm going to go ahead and run the unit tests using Docker run command. So I ran that Python test just by passing in, I'm calling it directly. I can also use the environment variable to do that for me. And that comes in handy when you're using Docker Compose. So in this case, I'm passing in the environment variable to say unit tests and then calling AdenaDoc. And so it runs AdenaDoc, it knows, oh, I just need to run the test and get back out. Does that make sense? To start the microservice, I'm not gonna do it because it'll collide with my Docker, but here, what it's doing is saying run, and does anybody know what this means, minus D? Run in the background, run daemon
mode. Oh, daemon mode, okay.
Yeah. So what this is doing, so you saw how this came, and I could see it run here. If I did minus D, it wouldn't have any output because it's running in the background. So
So, but it would finish and then.
Yeah. So.
So if you did Docker PS or something, right? Show which.
Yeah, you can see what. So it shows I got something running Jenkins from 2 hours ago. Okay. That's the only thing I got running. Another thing about Docker Compose, if you do Docker PS and you have like 10 projects on your machine that you're working on simultaneously, you'll see all that in a Docker PS. But if you use Docker Compose, you only see that for your project. So it makes it nice in isolation to spin stuff up and also tear it down and will not see all the other images out there. So it's kind of nice that way. So if I did a Docker Compose PS, I'm not going to see anything. But this is only for this project because when I run Docker Compose.
Oh, you can see the exited.
Yeah. So you can see the stuff that's been run in the past. What else can I cover here? So here's a Docker run. You know, what this is doing here, run in the background. Give it a name, Identidoc. So when I see it on the PS, I can see that that would be the name. Expose the port 5000 to 5000 my localhost. Run in dev mode. Link these two services that I started up above here. So that's a lot of typing to do. And Docker Compose makes it a lot easier. So I can just say Compose build. Everything's already been built, it checked, and so it went through all those stages. So here you can see the expose command, check the cache, it was there. The user checked cache there. So those are all the layers that caches image slices of layers. And then so the only thing that's a little tricky is if you want to run the unit tests, you know, it's a little busier command here, but you can still use Docker Compose to get that information. But here's where the power comes in of Docker Compose. So I have a program that I'm working on. Why isn't that copy? Why am I having trouble here? Sorry, guys. What this is going to do is say, bring up everything that's in that Docker Compose file and run it in the background. And it'll give you feedback of what's running in the background. Now, Docker Compose also comes with logs. If I want to tail logs, this will show all the logs at this point in time, but I can also use the minus F to tail. And I can see that the stuff is running or starting. I can also use Docker PS to see the status. Remember how we had a health check on there? They recently added the health. This was added like 6 months ago, where Docker had it, but Docker Compose, you couldn't see what the health status was there. So they now have added that. I can see that this is still starting, not ready. You know, I can do a watch on that. Now it's healthy. And if you're using like Kubernetes and stuff, and push it out there. If it failed, it won't override your current container, so it won't bring down your system. It'll just pop it out and say, you know, hey, I can't do anything because it's, you know, it's not getting healthy. So that makes it really nice for automation and pushing new stuff out and making sure that it's good before it actually kicks in that container. If you want to go look at specific logs, so like I'm saying, Identidoc, that's based on these names here. So I can look at the log output either from everything just by typing logs, or I can look at a specific, or even tail, I'll do a minus F Identidoc. You know, I could only see that.
So if you had Nginx in there, you could, and if you were only interested in Nginx logs, you could.
Yeah, so yeah. If you see here, I have Identidoc, and I'm looking at the logs. That makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's get back to here, and I think I'm getting close to being done with this. So that DN Monster and Redis, the Redis is a caching backend. So those are two microservices that is demoing and bringing up all together. So making it easy to system test on your local environment. Again, we talked about health check. Again, make sure it's critical to your service. We actually had somebody that brought down, they had like 20 some customers on their system, and they only had one instance of that Docker running because it's an old system and it can't run multiple things at the same time. And they had a microservices that was only particular to one customer that went down, and they were doing it as part of the health check. So all the other customers were impacted. And so you want to make sure that it's important, you know, only check what's important. So a better way to handle that is either streaming out the logs as a warning and have like a trigger on CloudWatch or something, if you're using Amazon, to alert saying, hey, this service is down, you might want to take a look at it. Or maybe just have the app itself send an email saying, can't see this non-critical service that might be impacting the customer. Another thing is make sure, I've seen several times where people have the health check, but they're doing such intensive stuff, it's like a heartbeat. You just see every time that, you know, Kubernetes is pinging, is it still healthy? It's like this big spike. And so you don't want something like that. You want to make
sure.
Health
check takes down the system.
Yeah, you don't want a denial of services because somebody, you know, hit it 10 times, you know, and brought down the system. So yeah, you want to make sure it's not impactive. And also, if it is impactive, maybe block it somehow so it's not exposed to the outside world where somebody could do a denial of service attack. Be wary of that. And logs, another thing, probably not for Python, maybe, but like in a Java world, a lot of containers and stuff. Like Tomcat out of the box does logging to a log file, and that's not good. So you start leaking in your container, and eventually it'll run out of disk space and crap out. So always make sure that you're going through, and like things where like Java, just go through the loggers and make sure everything's going to standard out or standard error. I don't know why their container by default doesn't. So they have an official Tomcat, and I still have it logging to a file. It's just, I guess they expect you to mount a volume to it. But a good pattern in Docker world is stream everything and look at those streams and see if there's problems going on. The Docker CLI. Basically, I'm not going to demo this, but you know, I showed you how to do a build with Docker Compose. This is also building that image, Identidoc, and give it a name, Identidoc. If you don't give it a name, it'll be some kind of hash or some weird name that generates automatically. So doing a tag will, this is how you'll see the images listed in the images. This dot here is saying build what's under this directory. If you have it in a different directory, you can, you know, say where that directory is at. And then the unit tests, you know, Docker run unit tests, we covered that already. What else can I cover here? This is how you run those microservices using Docker CLI. And see how long this is, you know, and how much stuff you'd have to remember how to type in with Docker Compose. You know, you don't need to document how to run it. Your Docker Compose is how you run it. Is your document. So if you have a lot of complex stuff, which some people do, it makes it easier. Do the same things in Docker Compose. You just do it this way. The only thing that's weird is the unit test. If you want to run that, that's how you do it. Once it's up, I guess I can hit localhost 5000. There. Now it is low. Well, I was thinking about let's cover other stuff. I already demoed the PS and logs of that. And the Terra Docker Compose, all that stuff down, all the networks and everything, images and volumes, just do Docker Compose down, and it'll tear all that stuff down for you. So it makes it easier to manage complex environments. I was gonna demo Jenkins. I don't know if we really need to cover that. You wanna cover that? Okay. So I have another project that's in that book as well, using Docker, and it's like, how do you run your continuous integration? And in that book, they use Jenkins. So I made a Git Docker Compose example running that. I already have it started up. Is I guess on port 8080. So if this thing ever come up. So this thing did come up. So if I type in any name here, if you want to see how this works. And that's Dennis.
Julian Overline. Just because I'm a narcissist.
Ooh, you're red. You're red monster.
Star Wars dancing. This is like a Rorschach test. I'm just gonna be quiet now.
So now we're seeing other people's personalities there. Okay. Localhost 8080. So I do have a Jenkins setup.
Password. I guess it might be just useful to explain to people what Jenkins is. People.
So Jenkins is a continuous integration server. It was one of the first ones out there, so it's kind of antiquated. There's newer ones out. I'll cover Travis as one of them. That's I like that because I do a lot of open source development. It's free for open source. It also supports Mac, which is extremely rare on the open source environment. It also spins up multiple, you can test multiple containers. So like if you have an app that needs to run in multiple containers, like Debian, Ubuntu, CentOS, Amazon. You can set up Travis to spin up those different machines and run the same test on those, and what they call a matrix. So Travis is pretty cool. There's a lot of things that copied them since then, like Circle, CI, Shippable, that's Docker container focus. There's a bunch out there. And most of them, if you're doing Windows development, there is also AppVare that will allow you to use it for free if you're doing open source Windows development. So this is Jenkins, and what it does is you point it to your Git repository and usually set up a trigger. So when you check something in, it will trigger your CI downstream and build automatically. And Jenkins used to always have to configure it yourself manually. And recently they added something called a Jenkins file to be more in line with Travis, because Travis has been doing that from day one, where you can check in your configuration for your Jenkins file. So you manage it as part of your code. And so here's an example of a Jenkins file I can go over real quickly. Here's my, this agent is, Jenkins is running Docker agents in the background. And you could have different names saying, you know, this is like a Debian agent or a certain tool agent that I want to run this on. In my case, I don't care what's running. It can be anything. These are environment variables set up. I want to tag my release based on the build ID that I'm building. This is the image I want to build. And these are this is the Docker Compose file. If you set this, when Docker Compose runs, it looks for Compose file to find out what Compose file you want to run. So that's what that's just doing. This is also looking for the project name that you want to give it in Docker Compose. These other options are Jenkins specific. I want the output colorized. I want it timestamped. I don't want to have concurrent. So if two people check into master, I don't want two builds running on master at the same time. I want to disable that feature. And I want to only keep the last 20 builds on my machine. The reason you want to do that, if you have like, it keeps all the artifacts that it builds. So if you have like a terabyte artifact that gets built by your build, you probably don't want to keep 1,000 of them out there. So you want to limit it. And in my case, I'm just saying only keep the last 20 builds. The stages, there's different stages of the build. So the first stage I call it pre-flight. What it's doing is it's setting the display name to the image name and release number it's going to be, and I just dump out the environment to the logs so I can see what's going on. It's nice when it's debugging, you know, make sure all my environment variables are there that I expect. This build step, since I'm running on my local machine, I need to do sudo here, and I call it build script. Normally, your build script would be all in here, but since I'm using the same build script here and Travis for the demo, I only wanted to keep it one place. So let's go ahead and take a look at the build script. And all this is doing, it's saying, what's my Docker Compose version? I want to build, I don't want to keep the cached, so I don't want it to hang around. I'm spinning up Docker Compose. So what this is doing is verifying that I can build it. If it can't build, I don't, you know, I want to stop here. This is bringing up the Docker Compose. And it got, remember I set it to CI, so it's using that Docker Compose YAML file based on environment variables. I'm running my unit tests. If that passes, go ahead and look to see if it got healthy. So what I'm doing here is saying for 2 minutes, you know, I'm sleeping 10 seconds, you know, 1 to 12, so 120 seconds. I'll run, wait 10 seconds, is it healthy? If it never gets healthy in 2 minutes, then I go ahead and blow up and quit. If it is healthy, health check pass. Otherwise, I dump out the logs in this order. If you just say logs, it'll be random order with all the pieces as they're coming up. But doing it this way, it's concise. I can say that this is Redis output, this is the monster, and this is the identidoc. And then exit with the healthy exit code.
And this just got up a little bit there. So we run the test to go, you run the unit test.
Mm-hmm.
Do you run that as, you don't run that in daemon mode, dash D, right? You
just no, run. So there's several modes we actually talk about. So when I do this up here, it's doing a run and brought it up behind the scenes. And it's continuous to run. This will exit out when it's done. So when this run is running, it'll run and exit out and be done with it. So it'll spin up its own separate container and get out.
So you're actually testing multiple things here. You're going to, you're testing the unit test and is Docker Compose up?
Is that so I brought up the Docker Compose. It takes a little while. So yeah. Go ahead and bring that up. And then this is in isolation. This will run another test while it's coming up because I, you know, it's going to take a while for it to come up.
And where do you run the integration test, or is that?
That's.
Or is that just with the health check under the hood? That
to me, that's my integration. Yeah.
Okay.
So, like, remember the healthy Z pattern.
Yeah.
You should, as a development, know what this container and what is healthy, and spin up everything and pass it that way.
So, in theory, you could at this point, once the Docker Compose up, you wanted to point it at sort of semi-realistic data and do semi-realistic testing with it. That's you would.
Yeah. So what I'm doing here, what am I doing here? The healthy check, just make sure that that one page comes up that you saw.
Okay. I see.
In this case, because okay.
So your healthy check is kind of your integration.
So this is return to 200. That return to 200, I'm good to go.
So in theory, you could also say something like there, do a curl, make sure the image looks like this if I give this thing. So
well, normally you want to do this. This is a pattern, healthy Z. You want to hit a page like that, and that would do whatever.
Application specific.
Yeah.
This
so it's only this. Thing. Yeah. So this is a page that's written for this particular image that all the pieces that you need to run. In this case, you know, this healthy Z would check that those two microservices are listening and responding, and that if I hit something, I got the output I wanted.
So to translate for the people listening at home, for researchers, what this means is that if you have some sample data that you know if somebody contributes to your open source research computing project, and you want to check that they haven't broken the code, and you have known test cases with known test data, you would do that in here. So
well, I don't know if I would do that here. I would do that as a separate step of that unit test.
Okay, so that,
More of the unit tests. Okay. And you can give them different names, like unit tests, make sure my Python's out. You know, that data, what was that, the continuous analysis?
Yeah.
That'd be another step, run my, you know, pass in the analysis parameter and says, okay, spin up and do this deep.
Okay.
Logic, whatever, testing,
yep.
And then can get results, and then you can move on next step, spin up the app. Is it responding if I put in certain input, you know, is it there to run?
Cool.
That type of stuff. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so.
So I'll go ahead.
You're running Docker inside Docker at this stage, right? So you're running
Docker, which I could make it run without sudo, but it requires sudo in this case. So I'm gonna go ahead. So this is in Jenkins, there's multi-branch. So if I created a branch called demo and checked it in, Jenkins automatically pick that up and show another thing saying the demo and to do your demo branch pass and build it as you make changes to it. I already built this like 3 months ago, it says. So I'll go ahead and just click this play button or force a build again. So I can see it's building down here and I can look at the output from the console. And so it found an agent, it's firing up that agent. Now it's running the Jenkins file script. It's building the image. There's the environment output sorted. Yeah, here's the build part. So it's downloading all these Flask and all the pieces it needs to run.
So I guess you could run this as a precondition before you push your Docker image to
right. That's a good point because I'm not doing it for this demo, but I do have a section down here. Once this did pass the build pass, I go to deploy, and only deploy on a certain branch. This branch I call never because as part of demo, I don't want to really push it to. And there's in Jenkins, it can hold the credentials because credentials should be secretive, right? And so you can't get direct access to it. So I use this with credentials plugin in Jenkins to grab a credential ID called Docker Hub and set the environment variable creds. And then I cat that to a config file for Docker. And then down here, I'm saying use that configuration to push to my target environment. And it'll look at that configuration. Like a Koi, it'd be a little bit more, but by default, things push to the Docker store. So it's pushed to the Docker store using my credentials that it got out of Jenkins for me.
So you can automate your pipeline for development so that you never, hopefully you never push broken Docker image.
Right. So this will, if it failed, it will never push the image out there. And then this step here, if everything goes, or even doesn't go well, even if there's failures, always ensure that you're tearing down the Docker Compose environment because you don't want to leave it up. And so that tears it down. To take a look at a Travis version of it, this is a Travis. Do I have a Travis output up here? There. So this is Travis CI I was telling you about, and it's showing, like I can see the build history out here. These are all builds to master. Takes anywhere from 2 to 3 minutes to build. And I look at the output. So it's doing basically the same thing. Firing it up, making sure my Linux box is up to date, and then doing the same steps, build steps that I had. And here's it's healthy. It's going through that. And the health check passed, exit 0, tear down Docker Compose, done. So that's the Travis CI look. And
So Travis in the hosted service, but Jenkins can yourself.
Jenkins you can run yourself. There's also another one that's getting popular called Concourse CI. As people, if you're doing complicated pipelines, I don't know if you know what that is, where you have a lot of upstream things coming in, you're trying to keep track of all the moving parts. Jenkins is good for that. They're the ones that kind of invented that, but somebody said, it's not easy to use. So somebody took the best of Jenkins and built Concourse and open sourced it. And that's a little cleaner. You can actually see things moving through the pipeline. I can see that somebody checked in, I can see how far it got on a complicated pipeline. So Concourse is a up and coming. I think it'll probably slowly pick up, but I think in 10 years, Jenkins will be fading away because it's kind of an older model of how to do things.
What about Travis? Travis doesn't have that feature.
Travis is pretty cool. It doesn't have those nice features for continuous deployment type models.
And it's not open source and it's not.
I think some can. I don't know if certain, somebody was telling me like maybe CircleCI, you can download it and run it yourself if you wanted to, but I can't remember which ones were which. Dinkins is free. I know Concourse, the up and coming one, is also open source free. The thing that's that Jenkins has everybody beat on it is it's been around for so long. I call it the Swiss Army knife of continuous integration because there's probably a plugin built. If you're doing some esoteric weird stuff that nobody ever heard of, there's probably somebody built a plugin for you so you can just use it on Jenkins. So that's what Jenkins buys you, where Concourse is fairly new. It's probably not as extensive on the plugins there. It's probably whatever the trends are current. Is there any more questions?
Yeah, so anybody remote who wants to ask anything to Dennis about maybe anything to do with Docker, Docker Compose, or Jenkins, or Docker inside Docker?
You guys are probably all sleeping.
There's a question somewhere.
Are you running Jenkins in Docker for this demo? Yeah. Yes, I'm actually firing up. I can show you that. Good question. So this is Identijink. And so if you want to see what the Docker Compose file that I spun up, this is it. Basically, build my local image. If it fails, restart it automatically. Here's the ports I want to expose, 8080 and 5000. And then these are the volumes I'm connecting to. So if you're spinning this up on your own, the first time you spin it up, you'll have to initialize. I already spun it up on my machine already. So I created a user. So what you do here is when you spin up for the first time, cat this admin password. That'll be the password that you need to log in for the first time. And then you'll set your own user ID. Install suggested plugins. I'm not sure what I... when you log in or when you spin it up for the first time on your local machine, what it will do here is prompt you. Here's a bunch of useful plugins that most people usually need in order to run out of the box. You want to install them. So yes, take the suggested plugins and then go get a cup of coffee or tea and come back in a half an hour and it should be done coming up. And then you'll create your admin user. In my case, I called it Jenkins user with a Jenkins password. I created a new multi-branch pipeline called Identijink. How you would do that is you come here to the Jenkins and say new item and say I want to do a multi-branch pipeline, give it a name and say okay, and it will ask you where that so the only thing that's critical here is what. So it's saying look for a Jenkins file to figure out how to configure myself. And the thing that's important is I want to use Git. You would paste in the Git clone for your Git repository. And if you have any credentials, you would need to add them or not. And then what this is doing is it'll automatically, if you have a lot of branches, it'll go ahead and discover all of them and try to build them for the first time when it starts up and then do the work. So I don't want to add credentials here, so I'm not going to do it, but this is how you basically just add the source to Git to point to your repository. And when you add credentials here, and if you don't have one here, where do you go for credentials? So I'm going to leave this page, abandon. Credentials, here you go. You would just add a new one that would have your, there's several different types. I'm trying to remember how this works. So I'd add a credential. It could be like username, password. It could be a Docker host certificate, SSH username with a private key. a secret file that you upload, secret text, or a certificate. So whatever, you probably have a username, private key that you can generate on your Git repository, and you just paste that in here for that username. And then you could go ahead and build those. So I never looked to see if this passed. It did pass. It built successfully 9 minutes ago. Here's the output of that build. So I had to download a lot of stuff.
You mentioned a book where you read about this and you updated the examples. What was that called if you wanted to find out more?
It's a little outdated. It's using Docker. But the principles, if you read this book, a lot of stuff like Docker Machine has been replaced with Docker for Windows and Docker for Mac. Things like that. Microservices have gotten a lot better. So it's kind of outdated, but the concept, if you want it for development, is just look over how do you build your unit tests, and you know, how can I run those in an image? What's the big picture like continuous integration and things like that? So, and again, I'm out on GitHub. If you go out there under D-H-O-E-R and just look for ident under my name, and you can see the identidoc, which tells you how to set up and run, how it's different. This is the link to the slide deck I just showed you. And quick start if you don't want to take the time to look through the slide deck. So, is there any more questions?
Yeah, one thing. So in the beginning, you were talking about how Docker replaces the need for things like Puppet and Chef. But what about, I mean, isn't there, don't they still have a role to play in kind of provisioning a server in the first place or orchestrating all your Docker things?
So there's two sides to that. That's a good question. There's what I consider the pipeline side. That's, you know, you got this image built, it's going to this environment, it passed all its tests. So usually in a Jenkins pipeline or what they call a pipeline in general for continuous, so CI, CD, that's continuous integration, continuous deployment or delivery. There's two different ones. Continuous deployment would mean it would go all the way to production. Continuous delivery, or continuous delivery would go all the way to production automatically, you know. There's no gatekeepers, and that's where you want to go, believe it or not, because that means when you hit at that level, everything's just so automated and tested that you're comfortable if it go through these stages. You know, you have a performance test, you have your deep tests that take some time. You know, it's going through all these different stages to vet that image, and then if it passes, why not go straight into production? You know, when you think about Obamacare, you think about Obama campaign. I watched a demo of the guy from Google that helped with trying to get Obamacare up and running. It was such a fiasco. And then another guy who worked on the Obama campaign. And the guy on the Obama campaign, they're pushing 40 changes to production a day. That's the difference where on the other side, Obamacare was traditional development. People are too scared to change anything, so changes took a long time to get through. People didn't want to, you know, if they messed up, they would get in trouble or you'd fired in some cases. So, but on the Obamacare or on the Obama campaign side, they were looking at, you know, they said they had the one time they probably had the best mathematicians in the world all working on a campaign. And they, if you looked at a screen, whether it was an iPhone screen or a tablet, and they would check to see if you went to the next page or how far you got, and they would kept changing design for a particular tablet or whatever size it was. And if you had more hits like in an hour than on the traditional, they'd automatically swap it in. I mean, that's what level they were on. They were checking all that stuff, and they're, like I said, they're doing at least 40 of those changes a day to production. You know, if you got a deeper web hit, they would automatically change it for the Android, the, you know, the person was seeing on the Android side, or iPhone. It was crazy. So that's continuous delivery. And the continuous deployment is if this goes through stage, and usually have a check, usually like production, you might have to go through like JIRA or something saying, yeah, approved at this time to go to production. When you use Docker, the thing that Docker makes nice, minus the database changes, is you can change the, you know, the automatic, like let's say I have 20 containers running to meet the needs on the website. If I put a new one in, I can say, I want to change out the first five and let them sit there for a while. If they pass, go ahead and percolate all the way out automatically. And basically I push it and I don't worry about it. If it fails, it's not going to bring down my system. It'll to say, well, I can't swap in these five because they can't pass health checks. So, I mean, that stuff used to keep you up all, you know, am I going to bring down the system, where like Kubernetes and stuff makes that, you know, it's got a lot of stuff built in. I'm not worried about bringing it down because it's got all those checks and balances. And so I'm free to push, you know, to pass the health check and then pass through all my stages, I can push to that environment, that production environment. So I probably rambled too much, but to answer your question.
I think a little different of a question. I mean, so if you have instead of your bare metal server so that it can host all of your applications,
yeah, there's two separate tiers. So there's the pipeline where you're worried about the image, and then there's the more of the site reliability engineering side that would set up that infrastructure for you and make it, and so you can push to that environment easily. You would probably have Ansible. Like, you know, if you're doing EC2, you have to bring up configure those servers manually. So yeah, you'd probably use something for that and use a tool like Terraform to, spin that up and then configure it the way you want to with Ansible or something, which is a Python-based tool for provisioning. So yeah. But from the software side development, I don't really need to be exposed to that. With these Docker Compose, if you're doing Kubernetes and they want to, if you want to see, or doing Swarm, what that comes in handy is, you know, if you spin up a like Minikube for Kubernetes and have two containers running, you might see, do I have like memory problems? I'm not sharing the thing. So if the person logged in and hit the other thing, I lost their data because I didn't have memcache set up right or forgot to cache it to memcache, stuff like that. That makes it nice if you're doing shared, multiple web apps on the same, go across. Does that make sense? But for the most part, usually teams keep that separated. But I guess it's coming back full circle. I'm thinking we used to have our SRE teams and they would manage all that stuff. But with the tooling getting so much better, we're actually pushing back to developers to own all those environments. And we usually have a pattern that they use this Terraform script to build out the EC2 the way we want to, and we use what's the other tool? They have a government's tool. I can't remember the name off the top of my head. Some bank created it, but it's pretty nice for security reasons. You don't want to, is it checking the S3 buckets exposed to public? It manages all that stuff really easily. So you'd spin up an Amazon used to be one count and you have to have a separate count. Now you have a master account and multiple accounts in isolation with your VPCs, and then have this government's tool checking to make sure that those people playing in the sandbox or compliant with your security needs.
So we should probably wrap up. So people want to hang around and ask questions. We'll keep the Zoom running. Otherwise, if people wanted to ask you questions directly, can they reach you somewhere? Should I
post? Yeah, you can either email me, or if you have questions, you can post it on Identidoc too, or how to run this. Go ahead and open
put
up
issues on the GitHub.
Yeah, put issues, use the tool.
Thank you very much, Dennis.
Appreciate it. Thank you.